Buenos días, ¿cómo estamos?
Muy bien, gracias.
Bien, excelente. Bienvenidos, good morning, welcome. Yo soy profesora Tracy Kwan, profesora asistente de la lingüística hispánica en este departamento de español y portugués. I'm assistant professor of Hispanic linguistics in the Department of Spanish and Portuguese, and just so grateful to have so many of you here, so many of you interested in what I believe is a really timely topic. Entonces, me alegro de que haya tanto interés en ese tema y que haya tantas personas aquí presentes hoy. Entonces, yo voy a ser la moderadora del evento de hoy, que se titula Knowledge, Rights, and Allyship: Navigating Today's U.S. Immigration Landscape. And we have two wonderful speakers with us today. Un par de cosas antes de presentar nuestras invitadas, okay? A few things before I introduce our invited speakers. Primero, me gustaría reconocer y agradecer el Departamento de Español y Portugués y también el Centro de Estudios Latinoamericanos y Latinx por ser patrocinadores del evento de hoy. So thank you so much to the Spanish and Portuguese Department and also to the Latin America and Latinx Studies Center for their sponsorship for today's event. La agenda para hoy es el siguiente. Empezaremos con unas preguntas ya preparadas, okay? Luego hablaremos de algunos recursos dentro de la universidad, pero también afuera. Y por último, terminaremos con preguntas de ustedes del público. Okay? The agenda for today is the following. So we'll begin with some pre-written questions. Then I will kind of point you to some of the resources that we've gathered both on and off campus. And then finally, we'll take questions from you, the audience. Okay? Este sí va a ser un evento bilingüe, ¿ok? Pero no vamos a traducir todo porque si no sería muchísimo tiempo, ¿ok? So this is a bilingual event, but we're not going to translate every single thing. Pero lo que significa tener un evento bilingüe es que ustedes pueden hacer sus preguntas, sus comentarios en inglés, en español, en Spanglish, ¿ok? And so in making this a bilingual event, we're basically just allowing you to use English, Spanish, or Spanglish to make your comments or to ask your questions, okay? If there is an answer that you're not quite understanding that you would like to be repeated in a specific language, you can talk to us after, or you can ask during the event if you would like to do so, okay? Además, vamos a grabar este evento y lo vamos a subir en nuestra página web del departamento para después, ¿no? O para compartir con otras personas si quieren, o para volver a recordar de los temas que hablamos hoy, okay? So we're gonna record today's event. Just keep that in mind. We're gonna put that on our department website. So you are welcome to share it or to go back, perhaps, and maybe go back to a question or a topic that you didn't quite understand or you just wanted to have that information repeated, okay? Y por último, voy a decir que desafortunadamente tuvimos una invitada, Laurel Herndon, de Boulder Ayuda, que tuvo que cancelar por último momento, pero sí tenemos sus folletos, okay? Sus folletos que hablan sobre sus servicios legales que ofrecen en el condado de Boulder. So we had one of our invited speakers, Laurel Herndon, cancel from Boulder Ayuda, but we have left their brochures that are bilingual brochures as well that talk a little bit about the free legal services they offer in Boulder County. Okay. Y con eso voy a presentar a nuestras dos invitadas y lo voy a hacer solamente en inglés para guardar el tiempo. Okay. Primero, we have Violeta Chatín in our beautiful purple dress, is an associate dean and clinical professor of law at Colorado Law School in Boulder. Professor Chapin directs the Criminal and Immigration Defense Clinic, and she and her students, some of who are present today, represent non-citizen clients in a wide variety of legal proceedings in both state and federal court. Professor Chapin joined the Colorado Law Faculty in August of 2009 after serving for 7 years as a trial attorney with the Public Defender Service for the District of Columbia. Professor Chapin attended college at Columbia University and received her law degree from New York University School of Law. And then next to Violeta, we have Alicia Saucedo Trowbridge. She is a senior associate with Murad Immigration. Prior to joining Murad Immigration, she was a senior immigration attorney at Community Legal Services in East Palo Alto, where she served low-income immigrants in the San Francisco Bay Area. Alicia received her law degree from the University of California, Hastings College of the Law, and her undergraduate degree from Stanford University. Merit Immigration provides representation in family-based and humanitarian-based immigration matters, as well as removal defense matters. Entonces, vamos a pasar a unas preguntas ya preparadas, okay? Les voy a leer las preguntas primero en español y luego en inglés, okay? So, primero, para Violeta, ¿qué es DACA? ¿Qué cambios se han realizado o podrían realizarse con la nueva administración de Trump? Y para los beneficiarios actuales de DACA, ¿qué consejos tiene y qué precauciones deberían tomar? And I'll repeat the question in English. What is DACA, or Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals? What changes have been made or could be made with the new Trump administration? And for current DACA recipients, what advice do you have and what precautions should they take?
Thank you, Tracy. Thanks to all of you for being here. I'm so delighted to see so many people here that are interested in this particular topic. DACA is Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. It was created in 2012 by then President Obama, who had a little bit of the background to it. Has anybody here heard of the Dream Act? Yeah. The Dream Act, I like to call it a unicorn because it does not exist. It has been brought up. The Dream Act would have been a bipartisan legislative change to our immigration laws that would have affected the same group of people, which is young people who were brought here to the United States when they were very small. Yeah. And I definitely got my trial room voice. And do you want me to come stand or? Okay. So it was for young people who had been brought here to the United States when they were very small and grew up essentially undocumented in the United States without any access to in changing their immigration status. The DREAM Act has been brought up no less than 19 times into Congress. It's always been a bipartisan proposal, and it has failed 19 times. In 2012, President Obama created the DREAM Act, which was an executive action, which are sort of, we're now becoming very familiar with executive actions. And so there's some good and bad to executive actions. They're not permanent, right? And they're not a change in the law. But what DACA did was that it allowed almost a million young people to essentially come out of the undocumented closet and to apply for DACA. And DACA gave undocumented young people two big things. It prevented them from being deported, right? It gave them some protection from deportation for the 2 years that they had DACA, and it gave them access to work authorization, right? And they would get a social security number by way of that. A big, big deal, right? And there were so many people whose parents, right, brought these young people to our clinic over at the law school to say, please sign my child up for this program. I can't wait for them to sign up. And the children were kind of like, at the time, they were like surly teenagers. They didn't really understand what was going on. And I made sure, because I'm a criminal defense lawyer, that they understood what the potential risks were of signing up for DACA. I was like, if you do this, right now your child is unknown to the federal government. But if you apply for DACA, they're gonna have to say where they live, they're gonna have to say who you are, what your names are, and they're gonna have to put their fingerprints into a federal database. And right now, President Obama is president, and we don't know who's gonna be president next. And then we found out who was president next. So in 2017, President Trump attempted to kill DACA. He attempted to end the program. He was immediately sued by lawyers. I've never been so proud of lawyers in my life. Immediate lawsuits ensued, and it went all the way up to the Supreme Court. And in the middle of COVID, June 2020, the Supreme Court ruled for the immigrants. Chief Justice John Roberts held that the way that Donald Trump tried to kill DACA was the wrong way. So DACA survived and is still just barely alive, right? Since then, there has been unending DACA litigation. It has gone back and forth. Texas, along with a bunch of states, sued to end the DACA program in Texas. They knew forum shopping is something that we talk about a lot in law school. You like to find judges who you think are going to rule in your favor. And so you file a lawsuit in the jurisdiction where those judges sit. Texas was a safe place for Texas and those other states who were very anti-DACA program to file to end the DACA program. There was most recent, so then it went all the way up to the Fifth Circuit, which is famously one of our most conservative federal circuits. The most recent opinion just came out January 17th of 2025, where once again, the Fifth Circuit held that President Obama exceeded his powers as president in even creating DACA, right? That the president by himself or herself one day cannot just defer, like decide that they're not going to deport people who are undocumented, right? The message that we've got loud and clear from the Trump administration is that there is absolutely no difference between an undocumented felon and an undocumented student. They're undocumented, they're undocumented, they're undocumented. I disagree. And thank goodness there's millions of people who disagree as well. But right now, there's lots of millions of people who agree with Trump, right? That an undocumented person is an undocumented person is an undocumented person, and our job, or the president's job, is to remove them, is to deport them. Right now, DACA is still barely alive for current DACA recipients. People who have had DACA all of these years, they are still eligible to renew. Despite the court's ruling on January 17th, they still issued what's called a stay of that ruling, and said right now the program is still alive until it finally goes up to the Supreme Court. DACA has not been open for a long time, except for like 6 months, in this brief time when Biden first took office. But new DACA recipients, so people who aged into DACA, because you had to be 15 to apply for DACA, have not been able to apply for the program. So there are, hundreds of thousands of people. Not that many, it's a dwindling population who aged into DACA, but after 2017, and so have not been able to get DACA. We have undocumented students here at CU Boulder, right? At the height of its program, there were 17,000 DACA recipients in Colorado alone. And they are spread throughout our university system, right? We've had three DACA recipients come through the law school, right? They come through medical school, they've been to business school, they're extraordinary. Right? And they are thriving despite all of the sh. And so what I'm telling them now is to, as best I can, right, is to stay positive. If you have DACA right now, you can continue to renew. If you do not have DACA and you're undocumented, we've admitting them. We certainly have undocumented students who don't have DACA here at the University of Colorado. The universities do not tell people you can't enroll just because you're undocumented, right? You don't even need a social security to enroll. You need to meet the minimum eligibility requirements, right, to get in, to get accepted, and then we're happy to take your tuition dollars. But I certainly believe, and I've been talking about this for a long time, for the last 10 years, that if we are accepting undocumented students here at CU Boulder, we have a responsibility to support them the same way that we try to support all of our students, okay? And so that's still a work in progress. I've got people, my students. Will you guys raise your hands real quick? These are the law students. Yay. Hannah was going over. My students and I work all the time with our undocumented students, helping them to renew their DACA, and to sort of face any other kind of legal challenges that they have. And so if you know undocumented students, you can always send them my way at the law school. We're happy to meet more of them, and to remain connected. And another piece of my job is to encourage our administration and the powers that be to do what they should do, which is to support all of our students in equal measure.
Do you want to take questions now related to DACA from the audience, or do you want to wait till the very
Let's wait till
end? Okay, perfect. Okay. Okay. La segunda pregunta. Okay. ¿Qué es TPS? ¿Qué cambios se han realizado o podrían realizarse con la nueva administración de Trump? Y para los beneficiarios actuales de TPS, ¿qué consejos tiene y qué precauciones deberían tomar? So, what is TPS or Temporary Protected Status? What changes have been made or could be made with the new Trump administration? And for current TPS recipients, what advice do you have and what precautions should they take?
TPS's temporary protected status is very similar to DACA in a lot of ways. Both TPS and DACA, if you have them, it doesn't change your immigration status.
It's about 8 of us going to standing room only out there, so we're going to just take a break.
Thank you.
TPS and DACA are what is called, it leaves people in what are called non-immigrant status, right? And the way that I talk to my students about the difference between an immigrant and a non-immigrant, mostly about like what is their intention. Right? An immigrant's intention is to move to another country and stay, right? Live there, right? Non-immigrant is like essentially the intention is to not remain, not always, but it's like, for example, our international students or tourists who come here, right? They're given non-immigrant visas. They're going to come here, hang out for a little bit, take a few pictures of some national monuments, and then they're going to leave, right? And go back to their countries. DACA and TPS recipients, since we don't give them any permanent immigration status, and that's one of the, I have a love-hate relationship with DACA and TPS, right? Like DACA did some good things for some. It definitely like increased opportunities for folks. It changed some people's lives in real way, but it didn't, it fell far short, in my opinion, of what they should get. TPS is kind of the same thing. So TPS is in our immigration laws, but it doesn't provide immigration status. And what it does is it allows the United States to defer the removal of people who are nationals of a country that is experiencing some catastrophe that makes it impossible for them to return. right? So, for example, Ukraine was designated for TPS protection. So, sort of Ukrainian nationals that were in the United States that couldn't return to Ukraine because of what's going on, right, were given temporary protected status. It's like the same form that you use for DACA essentially is done to apply for TPS. And it gives you deferred action, right? They won't deport you during the period of time that you have. It's 2 years long, presumptively renewable, but you have to keep reapplying. It's expensive, right? Those things, girl. And so they have to apply, they re-up it every time. So TPS, I've known about it since I was real small because one country that's had it is where my family's from. My mom's from El Salvador. And El Salvador was hit by two earthquakes back in 2001 that sort of demolished the country. And any undocumented Salvadoran national who was currently living in the United States, one important thing about US, about TPS is that in order to get TPS protections as a non-citizen, you have to be actually physically in the United States at the time that your country is designated for TPS protections. So some people are like, TPS makes people come here. It doesn't work for like El Salvador to be designated for TPS and then you immigrate from El Salvador and come. You won't get it. You had to be here, physically present at the time that your country was designated. So President Trump, again, also tried to kill TPS. He was singularly unsuccessful in killing TPS. Again, lawyers to the rescue. And so it stopped it. I think this time around, he learned a lot during his first presidential administration. I think one of the things that's really terrifying, he learned a lot. He's also a lot more powerful, right? Right now, he has a lot more federal judges in charge, the Supreme Court, they're all his friends, not all of them, but some of them. And quite frankly, the Dems are caving. Like what we're seeing right now is the Democrats right now are rushing to join with the Republicans on a ton of anti-immigrant legislation that they would never have done, you know, just I think even 6 or 8 months ago. Right now, I think TPS is in real trouble. And I'll say with DACA, no, just to come back to that for a second, if Trump were, and Stephen Miller and the people that are advising him were truly, truly smart, they would pass the DREAM Act. They would finally pass the DREAM Act because they now have control of Congress. And if they pass the DREAM Act, they would tie up the Latino vote for years to come for the Republican Party because they'd be like, the Dems couldn't give it to you, which is true. The Dems were singularly unsuccessful in getting them the DREAM Act. And if the Republicans did it right now, the Latino people, because the Latino people, we saw it this last election, you know, they're moving over to the Republican Party and passing the DREAM Act would be an extraordinary thing for the Republicans to do right now to solidify power in the Latino population for a long time to come. So if they were smart, they would do that. We'll see, right? TPS, there's not going to be any political fallback to them ending TPS, right? Because these are all the countries, the TPS litigation, remember when Trump called Haiti a shithole country? That's right at, he called it that, I won't say it again. He called it that, and then he tried to end TPS for Haiti. He's going to try to end TPS for Haiti right now, although if you look at the reports right now, Haiti is in a complete and total like catastrophic free fall, as far as we can tell. I don't know how they would say that it's like okay for anybody to go to Haiti right now. But they're going to do their best to end TPS for a lot of Venezuela has TPS. They don't like the Venezuelan migrants, right? They're going to end it. And so TPS is really on shaky ground because Trump learned a lot during his first administration. I think he's going to be able to end it effectively. He has a tremendous amount of executive power to make those designations, right? And he's got to figure out how to end the designation. Biden, right before he left office, extended TPS protections till 2026, as long as he could for a lot of these countries. So people are safe for a bit, but it's been hard. I'll end just by sharing with you one of the legal projects that we've had in the law school for the last 8 years almost has involved 12 of our TPS employees. They all from El Salvador who work here at CU Boulder. They are all custodians and dining service workers, and I hope that all of you, they are close and dear to my heart. Most of them have been working at CU for over 20 years as a custodian, which is a difficult and dirty job, and they don't pay them. Shh. These people, I hope that when you see your custodians and your dining services workers, you take a moment to say hello and thank you, right? I think sometimes when we're in college, we like ignore the people who work, the staff who are there, and we like, oh, the faculty, and oh, each other, and oh, myself, but not so much the staff. 8 years ago, my students and I convinced CU Boulder, we had to talk to Pat O'Rourke, who at the time was the CFO and legal, to initiate an employment-based visa process for these TPS employees, saying these are long-term employees who've been here a long time, right? And we have an interest, a business interest, in keeping employees. We, eight of them now have green cards. Eight of them have green cards. We were able to get them off of TPS. Yay! and get them green cards. My students and I learned a lot about the employment-based process. It takes a long time. The first hurdle, you have to go through the Department of Labor and prove that no American citizen or lawful permanent resident is willing and able to take those jobs. We sent our custodians through the process first. Not a single American citizen applied for those jobs. That worked out very well for our employees, right? And it also, I think, gives some information about like the one of the sort of tropes that we get, not just from the Republican right, it's not just partisan, is that immigrants are here to take our jobs, right? We hear that a lot, right? If we let them in, they're going to take our jobs. What we see from a process like that is that there are certain jobs that Americans will not take, and they don't have to take them. They don't want them, they don't have to. They've got lots of other options. We need immigrants to take these jobs. And these folks have been working wonderfully and faithfully at the university, and we love them, right? And so it took our dining services folks two tries to get through, because they make a little bit more money. It's kind of a more desirable job. But we got them through as well. And it was, I am forever grateful to CU Boulder for agreeing to do it. CU Boulder footed the bill for that. They paid like fees, thousands of dollars in fees for these employees. And so, yay. CU is not perfect, but I'm very grateful for that thing that they did. And so that is an example of people who are immediately affected, who live on our campus, that, you know, have been here for many, many years, working with us, working for us, who are part of our community. As one of the chief HR officers said to us about our dining services workers when we had to go ask them to go through the process again, it was gonna cost them some more money. She said, damn it, Violeta, they're buffs. Oh my God, I'm gonna go. So that's TPS and DACA. Happy to take more questions about that afterwards.
Okay, la tercera pregunta, this is for Valicia. ¿Existen otros programas o estatus migratorios que hayan sido reducidos o eliminados, o que estén en riesgo de ser reducidos o eliminados? So are there other immigration programs or statuses that have been reduced or eliminated or at risk of being reduced or eliminated with the new administration?
All right, so first of all, thank you. I'm not sure that I have a voice as big as Violeta, so if you can't hear me, just wave at me, especially in the back. In many ways, I'm being asked to predict the future, but there are some things that Trump has telegraphed that allow us to make some educated guesses. So I want to focus on a couple of things. I'm going to start with U visas. So I'm going to start with what is a U visa. So a U visa is actually, as Violeta was describing non-immigrant statuses, it's actually a U non-immigrant status. It is commonly referred to as a U visa. It is not, in fact, a visa. So in order to qualify for U non-immigrant status, you have to have been a victim of certain types of crimes. Unfortunately, one of the most common types of crimes that I see, both when I was working in legal services and now that I am working in a private firm, is domestic violence. So that's one of the most common cases that I have seen in my career. So if you are a victim of certain types of crimes and you cooperate with the police or with the DA's office and or with the courts or other law enforcement agencies in the investigation and prosecution of that crime, and you are able to show that you have suffered some sort of harm as a result of that crime, then you may be eligible for a non-immigrant visa. The problem with you non-immigrant visas is that, or you non-immigrant status, to be precise, the problem with this particular status is that there are only 10,000 made available by time to. And unfortunately, a lot more than 10,000 immigrant victims of crime per year. And so what this has done is they've created two major hurdles. The first is the processing time. If I submit a U non-immigrant visa application today, I am telling my clients to expect the processing time to be anywhere between 7 and 8 years. Processing time alone. And then by the time USCIS has processed that application, those 10,000 non-immigrant visas that are made available to applicants, they're gone already. So then there's a wait list. So while you're on that wait list, Today, my wait lists are about 3 years, give or take. In 7 to 8 years, someone who applies today, that wait list is not going to be roughly 3 years. It's going to be even longer. I am telling people that I would not expect a result from an application for new non-immigrant status to really give them some sort of result for 15 years. That's my best guess. Again, guessing. So this has been a problem, and it's been a problem that's been building for a long time. And under the Biden administration, there was a major change that was made. And that is that while you were waiting for that initial processing time during which you were previously not eligible for employment authorization, that you could get employment authorization. They've been coming a little bit randomly, and so there was issued these bona fide determination letters that indicated that USCIS had made a determination, basically that your application was complete and that as a result you'd be eligible for employment authorization. This, unlike a DACA employment authorization, do not also provide protection against deportation, but it does provide a Social Security number and employment authorization that was renewable, theoretically. So that's one of the very first things we absolutely expect to be asked. So there was already an executive action indicating that USCIS is to stop issuing employment authorization documents to unauthorized aliens in the United States. So, when you're looking through what that means and who that's going to impact, it's clear to us that the administration wants to take away employment authorization from, say, even asylum applicants. Oh, but wait, that's in the law. So, good luck with that. It can't be done simply through executive action, but he's absolutely going to try. But something like a U visa, somebody who is waiting for this 7, 8 years min, who would benefit so much from having employment authorization and a social security number, that I expect will go away. Now, let's consider the impact of such a thing, because the purpose of something like a U non-immigrant status is so that immigrants who are victimized at a far higher rate, I know what the rhetoric is, but the numbers show that it is immigrants who are victimized at a far higher rate than American citizens. This is going to cause people not to report to police, and the whole purpose of the U non-immigrant visa was and is theoretically to encourage people to come forward. We do not want to create an underclass of people who are repeatedly victimized and creating a situation in which people do not feel safe moving forward and talking to police, going to court, and having the people who have caused them harm prosecuted. But that is one of the impacts that we could see as a result of this. So when you're talking about there's an immediate impact to our immigrant community, this is definitely one of them. So I'm sorry I don't have happy news on this one.
Yeah, this wasn't going to be like
This is
an optimistic pep talk. Sorry.
in many ways, no, but I am. I have to say, I've had a lot of conversations lately, right, with a lot of immigration attorneys who are here and in the Bay Area, and still have a lot of ties. And it is really quite heartening, I must say, to see this room, standing room only, people sitting behind us and in the doorways. Thank you. Thank you for standing up for this.
Okay, pregunta Siguiente pregunta para Valicia también. Okay, the next question. ¿Quién es ICE y cuál es su autoridad y jurisdicción? ¿Cuáles son sus derechos? ¿Cuáles son sus derechos como alguien observando algo, pero también como alguien que está siendo interrogado? Right. So, who is ICE or U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement? What is their authority and jurisdiction? And what is within your rights as someone who is observing or who is somebody who is being questioned or detained?
All right, so let's break this down. Who is ICE? So ICE actually is composed of three separate parts. HSI, that's Homeland Security Investigations. They are ERO, Enforcement and Removal Operations, and OPLA, the Office of the Principal Legal Advisor. So for this purpose, you're mostly not going to be as interested in HSI. They are the investigative branch that looks at things like trafficking and people, goods, technology, etc. ERO, Enforcement and Removal Operations, that's who you're really interested in knowing about. So ERO are the branch of ICE that is tasked with enforcement actions. So that includes things like workplace raids. They are who we are being told to be afraid of. And we can talk about whether you really need to be afraid of them, because I think that that's part of the point. ERO is tasked with asking the questions, going and presenting themselves, say, at your home or workplace, a public location. So let's talk, because this is the real meat of it, about your rights if you are confronted with any law enforcement agent or officer. For this purpose, and especially if you are confronted by someone who claims to be either police or ICE, doesn't matter. Same response. One, yes, you do have to give them your name. No, you do not have to answer any questions about your status. You do not have to answer any questions about your country of origin at all. You respond, one, I am exercising my right to remain silent. You must say so out loud. Two, I want to speak to my lawyer. You don't have to give any explanations. You don't have to give any reasons. One thing, I'm exercising my right to remain silent. Two things, I want to speak to my lawyer. And then say nothing. Absolutely nothing. I have been detained by police before. Hi, brown woman. And it is very terrifying. I was not yet in law school at the time that I was detained. And my parents are both lawyers. And there was a lawyer who was in the building. And those 5 minutes before that lawyer walked out to help me were among the most terrifying that I've experienced. And I have a lot of access to information. And so this is why you have to know ahead of time what to do, what to say, and say nothing. It is extremely uncomfortable when an officer is looking at you. They might ask me even casual questions, be like, hey, you know, your accent's kind of familiar. Are you from the South? They are not your friends. They are not friendly. That like friendly conversation they're trying to have with you is not a friendly conversation. Give them nothing. Nothing. You are required to give them your name. That's it. Do not give them a false name. I get this question a lot. Do not give them a false name. That's a separate crime in and of itself. Please don't do that. Don't make it harder for your lawyer in the future. Please don't. Now, let's say that ICE shows up to your place of work, to your house, to your school. ICE can enter public spaces without a warrant. Right here, right now, where we are, this is a private space. If ICE were to show up right now, the two of us would walk over and we would ask to see a warrant. This is very important because ICE will issue these administrative warrants. This is not a judicial warrant. Ask to see it through the window, under the door. Do not open the door. Even though opening the door technically is not permitting them to enter, once you do, the door is open. Show that the warrant should be through the window, under the door. Make sure that it is, in fact, a judicial warrant. Look for the name of a court. Make sure that it is signed by a judge. And make sure there's actually a name on it, and that it is the name of somebody who either lives or works there. If that person does not live there, I'm sorry, you have the wrong address. This has happened. I've had a client who lived next door to someone for whom there was, in fact, a warrant, a judicial warrant, otherwise proper, lived next door. They said, I'm sorry, you have the wrong address. They came in anyway. We had fun with that. The lawyers will do that later. Do not resist arrest. If they violate your rights, then they very well may. Do not resist. That again be a separate crime. Bystanders. You have the right to film law enforcement operations in public spaces. It's trickier in private spaces. You may film, record, photograph in private space that belongs to you or that you have a right to be in. Do not enter suddenly, say you see ICE raiding your neighbor's house. Do not suddenly rush over there and enter the private property yourself. That's trespassing. You can film from outside. These are, as we've already said, these are potentially scary times, but our constitutional rights do not end no matter who is president. And it is very important to know that. Let the lawyers handle it later. Take down as much information as you can, especially if you're a bystander. And be ready to give that information to an attorney. Who was it? When was it? Exact as much detail as you can remember. Did they present a warrant? Did they not present the warrant? Did they break down the door? Give. Take that, especially as a bystander. And don't get yourself arrested too as a bystander. Let us handle it.
May I just quickly? So it's really important for people to understand that the immigration system is a civil system.
Yes.
Being here in the United States without proper documentation is a violation of our civil laws. It is not a criminal offense. That's why ICE can only come with what's called an administrative warrant, which has not been signed by a judge. There has been no information presented to a judicial officer that would reach the level of probable cause. It is signed by a civilian official at ICE, and that's why they can't break down your door. Right? A judicial warrant, example of a judicial warrant is what exists in criminal law land, right? That's an arrest warrant or a search warrant. If you don't answer the door with a judicially signed warrant, what are they going to do? They're going to come in, they're going to break down the door, and the police have the right to do that. But those are police that have warrants that have been signed by a judge. ICE does not, which is why we're telling folks, don't do it, right? But they come, and it's scary, and they also come at very inopportune times. They like to show up at like 4:30 in the morning when everybody's asleep, and people don't want the kids to wake up, mostly, right? And they figure just answering the door and opening it and talking to them, that will make them, but once you open the door, then they're in. They can move right in. They usually just walk right past you. They open the door just a little bit further, and they stand in your house. You don't have to do that, even if it's scary, and we appreciate that. We know how hard it could be. But we really want people to understand that ICE doesn't have the right to break down your door if you don't open the door. Now, they can wait outside. One of the things that just recently happened is that immigration, Trump didn't do this during his first administration. I was surprised by it. But for a long time, ICE has had a policy of not conducting and what they call enforcement actions at sensitive locations. Those sensitive locations are churches, schools, and hospitals. They didn't rescind it during Trump 1.0. They just rescinded it just the other day. So some of you may have heard during the first Trump administration that there were some undocumented people that were living in sanctuary right here in Boulder, right? There was a very famous woman, right, who made the Time magazine as one of our most influential people of 20, whatever year it was, right? She was undocumented completely, had a removal order, and she was in sanctuary at a church here in Boulder. ICE knew exactly where she was. If she was in Time magazine, people knew where she was. They never went in there to get her. Now, Trump no longer wants to tie the hands of Immigration and Customs Enforcement. And I do think they have plans, right, to in fact not allow churches to take people into sanctuary, to go potentially arrest undocumented pregnant women who are giving birth in a hospital, and potentially to come into schools, right? And that has real ramifications for universities, right? Like CU Boulder, what are you going to do, right? I think we have been clear with CUPD that an administrative warrant, what we've got right here is FERPA, Federal Right to Privacy Act, which protects students. We, as the teachers, are not allowed to give information by that federal law to almost anybody. The only thing that pierces FERPA is a judicially signed warrant. If one of y'all is accused of homicide, sorry. We're going to have to help them find you, right? But, I mean, we've had people call up the law school talking about, you know, is Hunter going to class? I'm like, I'm sorry. I'm not able to tell you any of that. You want to hire a private investigator, I guess you can find out if your child is going to class. But we're not going to tell you that information because of FERPA, right? And we've told the UPD an administrative warrant does not pierce FERPA. And typically law enforcement, you know, just as law enforcement does, they like to help each other, right? That's their homie in another law enforcement division. But I know you might want to help immigration, but you cannot when it comes to immigration enforcement and administrative warrants. You cannot help them. They are protected by FERPA. If anybody comes to any campus, to a professor, to any staff, to any student, and asks you where Violeta is, or any other student who might, you know, immigration might be interested in, your answer